Can we start with the Institute for Race Relations? Hello, Chair. Thank you. I would like to do a PowerPoint presentation. So I wondered if you could make that possible for me, that I may share my screen.
Committee Secretary, can you allow her to share the screen? Her screen? Sorted.
Should I proceed?
Yes.
If I can. Thank you.
Mr. Geoffrey, you have 20 yes. minutes.
Thank you very much. And I'd like to thank the committee for giving us the opportunity to talk today about this important bill, which has been improved in many ways from the 2016 version, because the insult provision has been dropped and the definition of hate speech has been narrowed, though not enough, as I will explain in due course. The list of grounds are a little narrower and no longer include occupation or trade, at least in the hate speech context. The prohibition of aiding, encouraging, or promoting a hate speech offence has been omitted, and importantly, potential prison terms for second or further repeat offences have been cut from a maximum of 10 years.
Recording in progress.
Sorry, I seem to have lost my place now. I can continue. Important defences have also been introduced, particularly for those engaged in academic and scientific inquiry, or for people involved in the fair and accurate reporting of news in the public interest, that many people will not be covered, including political leaders talking to their supporters, and probably most people when they post on social media. And the definition in the bill must comply with the Constitution, and we know that 1616(1) gives everyone the right to freedom of expression, including freedom of the press and other media, and the freedom to receive or impart information or ideas, which is very wide. However, under 16.2, this right does not extend to propaganda for war, the incitement of imminent violence, or advocacy of hatred that is based on race, ethnicity, gender, or religion, and that constitutes incitement to cause harm. So that's what the Constitution says, but the definition in the bill is very different, as I'll come to in a moment. Just to elaborate on what Section 16.2c requires, the words used must advocate hatred, and hatred is an intense and extreme emotion linked to vilification and detestation. The hatred expressed must also be intentional, because it can't be accidental or subconscious. The words must advocate hatred on the basis of race, ethnicity, gender, or religion. This list is a closed one, making it different from the open list of 17 grounds of unfair discrimination in Section 9 of the Constitution. And the advocacy of hatred on one of these listed harms must also be accompanied by incitement to cause harm. The mere advocacy of hatred is not enough. Incitement is always intentional, and it too cannot be accidental or subconscious. By contrast, the bill defines hate speech as the intentional communication, including to a single person, of material that could reasonably be construed to demonstrate a clear intention to, one, be harmful or to incite harm, or two, to promote or propagate hatred. And it must do so on any one of 15 listed grounds, including not only race, ethnicity, gender, and religion, as under Section 16.2, but also 11 more. Is this definition validated or saved by the Constitutional Court judgment in the Kolani case? The bill's definition is taken largely from the wording approved by the Constitutional Court in that case in July 2021. So there will be people who argue that that makes it perfectly fine. And in that judgment, Judge Stephen Majeed ruled that Section 10 of PAPUDA, the Promotion of Equality and Prevention of Unfair Discrimination Act of 2000, went too far in barring hurtful speech. Hurtful was too vague to comply with the rule of law, and it could also prohibit speech that merely offends, disturbs, and shocks. Parliament was given 24 months to remove hurtful, and the rest of the definition in Section 10 was seen as being in keeping with Section 16.2, provided that the exception was presumed to apply. Majeed, however, failed to follow the lodestar precedent on hate speech laid down by the Constitutional Court in the Islamic Unity case in 2002. That judgment found that all speech is protected unless it falls squarely within Section 16.2. Any law that limits protected speech must meet the justification criteria in Section 36, and that's the approach that ought to be applied in adjudicating on hate speech. But Majeed didn't follow that approach, which is the first problem with his judgment, as it is settled law that this is the right way to proceed. He also ruled that speech which is harmful is much the same as, in other words, it aligns with, he said, the advocacy of hatred, but the correlation is very far from clear. He also found that words that promote hatred accord with the advocacy of hatred. But again, the correlation is far from clear because advocacy requires lobbying, a more intensive intervention. In addition, Majeed brushed over the rest of Section 16.2c, that speech is unprotected only if it advocates hatred on one of the four listed grounds and also incites harm. In addition, Majeed was dealing with civil law liability under PAPUDA, which is not aimed at punishing the wrongdoer, as the judge said, but rather at finding the right remedy for hate speech. By contrast, the bill does involve criminal liability. It makes hate speech a crime, which is punishable by up to 3 to 5 years in jail, along with fines of an unspecified magnitude. And criminal liability has a particularly chilling effect. The offender, who is seen as having committed the crime of hate speech, faces arrest, detention, remand, and trial. And the very existence of that crime stifles reportage, as the Zimbabwe's highest court warned in 2014 in dealing with criminal defamation rules there, which it said had very often prevented merited criticism of the president and his government. In a criminal law context, as in the bill, the definition of hate speech must be fully in line with Section 16.2. And that makes it all the more important that this definition should be rejected and that it should be recast so that it is fully in line with Section 16.2. A definition which is not fully in line has to meet the justification criteria in Section 36 of the Constitution. And the present definition in the bill would not meet those justification criteria either. To focus on just three of them, first of all, you have to look at the importance of the right that is being limited, and free speech is vital to democracy, as the Constitutional Court has often said in a number of cases. Secondly, you need to look at the importance of the purpose of the limitation, but there's no pressing need to go further than Section 16.2 allows. And in addition, are there less restrictive means available to achieve the limitation on hate speech which is desired? And obviously this is so because we have civil defamation rules and we also have Section 10 of PAPUDA, so this needs to be revised. What is the best way forward on the hate speech clauses in the bill? The government should revise Section 10 of PAPUDA to bring it into line with Section 16.2, as the Supreme Court of Appeal in Kwilani ruled. And the hate speech clauses in the bill should then be removed. There's no need for any criminal punishment for speech. It's enough to have an amended Section 10 of PAPUDA, plus the rules of civil defamation, which protect people and their reputation. If we look back to 2010, the African Commission on Humans and People's Rights was particularly concerned about the negative consequences of criminal defamation rules in the laws of various African states. It believed that they had a chilling effect on reportage, and it urged that all these criminal defamation rules should be repealed. Our own Jeff Radebe, then minister in the presidency and the ANC head of policy in 2015, said that South Africa would indeed repeal its own criminal defamation rules, which the ANC regarded as being contrary to the constitution. And Mr. Radebe also said that no citizen or journalist should have the shackles of criminal sanction hanging over him or her. Yet the government has reneged on that commitment to repeal criminal defamation laws. Instead, it is proposing to enact a new definition to criminalize hate speech in a way that goes far beyond the rules of criminal defamation and is even more disturbing. If we look briefly to the problems with the hate crime clauses in the bill, hate crime is defined as an offense which is recognized under any law, but the commission of which is motivated by prejudice, bias, or intolerance toward the victim based either on his or her race or on 16 other listed characteristics. All elements of a hate crime, including the relevant motivation, need to be proved beyond a reasonable doubt. And that may make it harder to secure convictions, in fact. If we think for a moment about Victor Mocha and the Coffin case, which was so notorious, as many people will remember, Mr. Mocha was walking past a farm in Mpumalanga when he was accosted by two white men who worked on the farm, and they assaulted him, they forced him into a coffin. And the news of this came out a number of months later because a video was taken, which then went viral. And because of the existence of that video, if it had been necessary for the prosecution to prove that the perpetrators in that case had a racist motivation, this could have been achieved. But without the video, it would have been very much more difficult to do so, because the accused could have argued, for example, that their motivation had nothing to do with race, that they were simply afraid, farm murders have been intensifying in South Africa or occurring in South Africa for a number of years, and this could be seen as a legitimate reason for fear. And seeing into the mind of a perpetrator is very difficult, but suddenly now that the prosecution must be able to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the motivation was racial and not anything else. There's also some very strange wording in the bill in that it says that if minimum sentencing rules do not apply, then the commission of hate crime is an aggravating circumstance that warrants harsher punishment, provided that the victim has also suffered physical or other injury or some kind of economic loss in the form of damage to property or loss of income. So in other words, what the bill is saying is where a crime is of a particularly serious kind, such as murder or rape, where minimal rules do apply, then that motivation is not going to count as an aggravating factor under the bill. So one wonders, therefore, what purpose or what advantage the bill is actually achieving, especially because courts already have the power under the common law to regard a racist motive as an aggravating factor in deciding sentence. And it's enough if this motive can be proved on a balance of probabilities. Proving something on a balance of probabilities is far easier than proving it beyond reasonable doubt. So the common law already meets the need by saying we can take account of a racist motive as an aggravating factor in sentence, and by putting the burden of proof on the prosecution at a lower level, at the level of proof on a balance of probabilities. Deputy Minister John Jeffrey said in 2015, it's a misconception to think that in the absence of hate crimes legislation, those who commit hate crimes will get away with it, when in fact they already face harsher penalties under the common law. And he cited the example of Duduzile Zozo, who was a lesbian who was murdered in Tacova on the East Rand. And when the accused came to trial and to conviction, the presiding judge in the case recognized the kind of difficulties that face vulnerable people in the situation, and said he was therefore going to impose a harsher penalty than the norm. And so the perpetrator was sentenced to 30 years imprisonment, showing in operation that the common law can already meet the purpose which the bill is trying to achieve. So there's no need for the hate crime clauses. They're simply an unwarranted complication in criminal trials. Most convictions will still be for the underlying offence, murder, rape, assault, kidnapping, because murder is so difficult to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. So if we look to the best way forward in general, the IRR urges that the bill should be abandoned in its entirety. The hate speech clauses are unconstitutional. They go beyond what Section 16.2 allows, and they cannot be saved by a justification provision in Section 36. And the hate crime ones are simply confusing and therefore inconsistent with the rule of law. And neither the hate speech nor the hate crime clauses are necessary, because we have other ways of dealing with the problems which they are trying to solve. We should amend Section 10 of BAPUDA, as I said, so that it echoes the wording of Section 16.2 of the Constitution. And we should ensure that BAPUDA is even-handedly applied to all South Africans, regardless of race. We should follow the approach of Judge Roland Sutherland in the Vilapi Khumalo case. As people may recall, Vilapi Khumalo was an official in the Gauteng administration who spoke about the need for whites to be hacked and killed like Jews. And when the case came before the Equality Court in Johannesburg, Judge Sutherland said, let us apply in deciding whether liability for hate speech is present, we should be scrupulous to uphold equality before the law. We should not give black people a greater license to speak and try to silence white people. What we should do is apply equality before the law equally to perpetrators and deciding whether they are guilty or, and then look at all the surrounding circumstances, the entire social context, when it comes to devising the right remedies for the hate speech for which they might be responsible. And we should also ensure an even-handed application of the common law when it comes to using a racist motive as an aggravating factor in determining sentence. That again is intrinsic to Section 9 of the Constitution and its emphasis on equality before the law. In conclusion, the government should build on the racial goodwill which is strongly evident already in the country. The IRR has commissioned 8 opinion polls touching on racial issues, the first carried out in 2001 and the rest in every year between 2015 and 2021. And always in those polls, we start by asking people what they think are the 2 most serious unresolved problems for the government to address. And very few South Africans, including very few black South Africans, identify racism as a problem of that nature. In the last poll we did in 2021, there were 2% of black respondents who identified it in this way, whereas very many more identified as pressing problems, unemployment, crime, poor living standards, poor quality of education, and corruption, for example. So the results of the IRR's opinion polls have repeatedly confirmed that race relations are generally sound, that there is no looming racial crisis in the country that could justify the bill. The government should recognize, as ordinary South Africans seem to do, that the reprehensible racial utterances and the conduct of the few are not representative of the many. And it would also help if the ANC itself were to stop promoting racial polarization through race-based policies and damaging invectives. Instead, it should implement meaningful economic and other reforms for increased investment, growth, employment, and prosperity as the most effective means of improving social cohesion in the country and ensuring that all South Africans have a real prospect of a better life. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Jeffrey. Members, are there any comments or questions to Dr. Jeffrey? Are there any questions or comments? None. Thank you very much, Dr. Jeffrey.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. The next one, Committee Secretary.
The next one is Accountability.
Yes, Accountability Lab, South Africa.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Honourable Members. Before I begin, Chair, I do have a presentation, but it's merely for illustrative purposes. I don't know if you would like for us to maybe proceed with that.
Yeah, proceed. You have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Chair. All right. Thank you, Honourable Chairperson, and thank you, Honourable Committee members, for the opportunity to make this oral submission supporting our written representations to the Prevention and Combating of Hate Speech and Hate Crimes Bill. Before I begin with the presentation, perhaps just to say, just to let you know a little bit about ourselves. At Accountability Lab, we are working to build people-driven initiatives which advance social and public service accountability across the 11 countries in which we work, from Nepal to Mexico, across our translocal network. We are developing a new generation of active citizens and responsible leaders to produce a world in which resources are used wisely, decisions benefit everyone fairly, and people lead secure lives. I am Sigwetlani Phamodi, and I'm the Director for Accountability Lab in South Africa. More than my own special interest and participation in the advocacy efforts and formal processes which gave rise to the development of this bill in the first place, it is our commitment to supporting people to live secure lives as well as Accountability Lab's special interest for the prevention and combating of hate crimes and hate speech bill. Our view of social and public sector accountability is one in which society is supported to build values, norms, and behaviors which enable us to be accountable to one another in the enjoyment of our rights and freedoms. More than the urgent and necessary laws which prohibit harm and give rise to both civil and criminal remedies where it is experienced, we believe that South African society requires greater investment in proactive measures which build and promote mutual respect for difference and understanding for our diversity as people, regardless of our religious beliefs, our sexual and gender identity and presentation.
Mr. Nduna, we are disturbing our meeting. Mr. Nduna, we are disturbing our meeting. Please proceed, sir.
Thank you, Chairperson. And so, as I was saying, we believe that South African society requires greater investment in proactive measures which build business, I think that I'm having it. Proactive measures which build My apologies, Chairperson. So we believe that South African society requires greater investment in proactive measures which build and promote mutual respect for difference and understanding for our diversity as a people, regardless of our religious beliefs and cultural backgrounds, our sexual and gender identity and presentation, our professions and racialized characteristics and identity, or other attributes that people may be organized around. Our view is that the work that is required from us in preventing and combating hate crimes and hate speech goes well beyond merely criminalizing these undesirable behaviors, which divide our society, and marshalling state and social institutions to efforts which unite us in our diversity. So moving on to my substantive submissions, it's very clear that South Africa has an apparent hate speech and hate crimes problem. As we have submitted in our written representations, South Africa has been grappling with and perhaps been losing the challenge around attending appropriately to our apparent hate speech and hate crimes problem. Since at least 2008, when we saw a dramatic rise in the nationalist and anti-Black xenophobic sentiment and violence we are seeing surging again today, there have been urgent calls for policy and legislation to respond to hate speech and hate crimes in South Africa. The leadership of the women's movement and LGBTIQ organizing formations has also brought the language and frameworks we are reflecting on today in their advocacy towards an action plan that will keep women safe. And I think that we can speak to or point to the hate crimes task team as one example of this. It is particularly the queer women and gender non-conforming people who have suffered sexual and gender-based brutalization linked directly to their marginalization in society under the message crime we currently and very clumsily call corrective race. Further, as South African society continues to be racially polarized, such as we are seeing, we are also seeing and hearing more about the institutionalization of anti-Black racist speech and exclusion. Significantly, if we consider for a moment what underpins the hate which qualifies the speech act and conduct this bill seeks to make an offense, is the marginality of the people who typically fall victim to that hate. Alongside women, Black people, and LGBTQI people are African foreign nationals, sex workers, and any person who not only does not enjoy the esteem of society in the main, but are all the more available to unfettered violence and victimization as a direct result of how society views the physical or social attributes that they have been identified with. So there, it doesn't matter whether you fall under this category or not, it is that you are identified with it that makes you particularly vulnerable and available to violence, because people deem that attribute or category as being undesirable in society. The work of this committee should be squarely focused on supporting and protecting the people on the margins, people like myself, from brutalization, violence, and victimization, because their difference positions them as outsiders. We have made our specific and detailed submissions to the bill in our written submissions and wish to use this time before this honorable committee to focus on two key aspects. The first pertains to the definition of harm. The definition of harm in the bill, as it is currently rendered in the bill, is currently framed as follows. Any emotional, physical, psychological, social, or economic harm. It is plain to see that the definition is not only vague, but circular, relying on the qualification of harm in order to define harm. So in order for us to know what harm is, we have to say, well then, is it emotional harm or psychological harm? We very clearly need something more here. While we presume the intention of the committee is to cast a wide net for the various ways in which harm may be suffered, it is important for the sake of clarity that harm itself be provided a more lucid definition. To this extent, we propose a definition which is grounded in quantifiable loss or impairment as follows. Any quantifiable emotional, psychological, physical, social, or economic loss or impairment objectively established as being detrimental to the enjoyment of rights, including to property. We must remember that the message crime that a hate crime functions or operates as is not only linked to the physical person, and the physical harm that they might, the physical or emotional, psychological harm that they might suffer, it also is linked to their rights including to other rights, including the right to property. And it's significant that we do also engage that in how we define harm. More than the clarity in our understanding of harm that the proposed definition offers, it also distinguishes harm from mere offence, mindful that no one has a right to protection against offence to their person or sensibility, but only a right to be protected against the quantifiable harm that may derive from harmful speech acts or conduct, which may also themselves be offensive. This is significant in order to curtail the abuse of the law, the abuse of the law in the pursuit of spurious claims related to offence, and which may be pursued through existing facilities like the criminal offence of crimen injuria, the civil remedy for reputational harm or distress. I remind the committee again that our work is to support and protect people on the margins from brutalization, violence, and victimization because their difference positions them as outsiders. I now wish to turn to the offense of hate speech, or to my submissions on the offense of hate speech itself. Now, the offense of hate speech must follow the harm and not the speech act. This is really the crux of our submissions in this regard. A clear definition of harm is also significant for the construction of the offense of hate speech. So as we currently have it, and you can see it there on the screen, it's clear that the harm is really the question here. If we consider this formulation, in section 41A of the bill, the offense has two components. The first is the intentional commission of a speech act, and the second, a demonstrably clear intention to cause or incite harm or promote or propagate hatred. I think this is clear enough. The speech act must be linked to a quantifiable loss or impairment or propagate hatred, thereby causing or ripening the conditions for harm, as we have provided a proposed redefinition for. And that, however, subsequent subsections, namely subsection 41B and C, go on to make the commission of further speech acts containing hate speech themselves an offence without qualification. I think we want to go slowly again here. What they do is make the commission of further speech acts. You speak in a way, you publish something, you distribute something that contains hate speech itself, right? Something that we all know and agree reasonably constitutes hate speech. And the distribution itself, without any kind of qualification, without any kind of contextualization, itself becomes the offense. Now, while we understand the importance of curtailing the electronic distribution and gratuitous display of speech acts which constitute hate speech, we believe that a blanket prohibition on the distribution of speech constituting hate speech without due consideration of the purpose and context in which this is happening disregards the varied and objectively reasonable bona fide purposes for which it would be distributed. Perhaps you want to do it for the purposes of educating at a popular level rather than through a scientific or academic process. Perhaps you want to demonstrate that this is in fact happening, and you also perhaps even want to take the further step of demonstrating your complete disdain and rejection of such speech acts. Under this current construction, this would itself be an offense. Now, one might say that the exclusion provisions in subsection 2 address this concern, and these appear on the screen then, with my emphasis. However, these, we believe, are insufficient for enabling society as a whole to witness and negotiate the relationship between and the limits of what may be offensive speech as well as what may constitute hate speech itself, which is really where the work of marshalling state and social institutions to the efforts which unite us in our diversity lies. We must be able to get it wrong in order to get it right. This necessarily includes sharing, seeing and hearing where and how hate speech may have been committed, having dialogue around why it is wrong, as well as incorrectly sharing in society's outright rejection of what constitutes hate speech. Without this, we simply create a chilling effect on our right to freedom of speech itself. And so to the extent the exclusion provisions in section 412 do not address this concern, we propose that section 41A be revised as follows. And there in bold is really the addition. We propose that the exclusion principle or the exclusion provisions include the intent of propagating hate speech in the distribution in order to be able to safeguard our rights to freedom of speech and our ability to negotiate, engage, learn from one another through doing and through engagement around where our limits lie as a society as far as hate or as far as offensive speech is concerned, and for us to also know and teach each other what it is that clearly constitutes hate speech and why it should be condemned with the contempt that it deserves. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Accountability Lab South Africa. Any questions or comments, members? None. Thank you very much, sir. Thank you for the presentation. We are still going to come back to the presentations with the department where they have to respond to all the presentations that have been made. And then thereafter, we will engage the presentations and go to the bill clause by clause, taking into consideration everything that has been raised through the public hearings and what is contained in the bill. So thank you very much, sir. Access chapter. Access chapter 2.
Thank you very much, Chair. Through you, I would like to request to proceed without the use of video for data purposes and connection. First, there's no presentation to share at the moment, but we'll present from our previous submission. Okay, my name is Mpho Bunze. I'm the associate responsible for communications and projects at Access Chapter 2, and we'll be delivering this oral presentation together with my colleague, Risan Mojapili. Who are we? At Access Chapter 2, we are registered as a non-profit organization, working within the space of promoting and protecting the rights of the LGBTIQ plus community, women as well as girl children. We do this through the provision of direct services, capacity building and awareness, legal and advocacy services, as well as research development. As Access Chapter 2, we were founded in 2014, and to date, we have a national footprint with active 7 provinces, running our work in provinces. Now, it is estimated that about 25 members of the LGBTIQ plus community have been brutally murdered across the country between the years 2020 and 2022. And among these many names, we remember the name of Sam Mbata, Bonang Khailaye, Lindohuhle Qele, Andile Lulundutela, Nathaniel Spokhwane Mbele, and many others. Now, although many of these names may stand out, so many of them did not make it to the headlines. Now, we look at the definition of hate crimes, and for us, these are crimes that are overt acts that can include acts of violence against persons or property, violations or deprivation of human rights, certain true threats, acts of intimidation or conspiracy to commit these crimes. And I just highlighted the names of individuals from the community who have lost their lives brutally, mainly because of what we deem as hate crimes. Why is it necessary for this law to take shape in South Africa as a context? For us, hate crime and hate speech bill is seen as a cornerstone for protecting the rights and lives of LGBTIQ plus community. Therefore, the bill creates the legal definition of hate crimes, which will compel authorities to collect and report details about hate incidents for effective monitoring, analysis of trends, and appropriate interventions needed. And we have been playing a central role in terms of the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development Hate Crimes Working Group and National Task Teams. And what has come up as one of the critical issues is this idea that there is no registry at a national level that contextualizes these hate crimes against the community. The hate crime study conducted by ourselves, OUT Triangle Project, alongside three other organizations, found that about 88% of the LGBTIQ plus community do not report incidents and attacks against them, making it 1 in 25 LGBTI people only getting to report these incidents. We believe that this emanates from the fact that many of these cases are centered around the fact that victims are scared or afraid of further victimization by those that are meant to provide services. We speak here of law enforcement, we speak here of judicial spaces that are meant to protect the LGBTIQ plus community. Now, we make our submission based on the fact that there are lived experiences that we have come to document ourselves as an organization. We believe that LGBTIQ plus persons report to have experienced physical beatings with the hope that their behavior would change, or that the non-normative expressions would leave them. This was common amongst male children who behave effeminately and female children who behave in a masculine manner, who in the main were verbally reprimanded to change their sexual orientation and or gender identity to that which suits their parents or members of the community. Emotional abuse was another practice in the home environment as an attempt to change the non-normative expressions. Parents were also found to accuse the suffering in the home environment because of the cares by the ancestors who are not pleased with their abnormal behavior, while others are disowned in certain parts of the house because parents believe that they have demonic or evil spirits which would contaminate or affect their siblings in general. And this is also supported by research that we did in partnership with Outright International on this idea of conversion practices. members of parliament would be familiar with the term conversion therapy. But in the context of South Africa, as we are the first people to actually contextualize research on understanding conversion practices, we refer to these practices as methods that are used to change or reset a person's other gender, identity, expression, or sexual orientation to heterosexuality or cisgender. Now, in our study, we spoke and engaged to, we engaged about 303 participants who, all of them, shared their lived experiences regarding these harmful practices, more especially happening in household environments and communities. We find that there are many perpetrators, but the biggest perpetrators of conversion therapy remains to be parents and family members, but over and above that, religious leaders, therapists or psychologists, traditional healers and traditional leaders have also been found to perpetrate these harmful practices. So for us, it was important to contextualize this as a way of aiding the importance of having the Hate Crimes and Hate Speech Bill as law in South Africa. Now, hate as a harmful practice, for us, we believe that it does not end there. It starts as hate speech and grows to be hate crimes. So in a way, hate speech and hate crimes are closely interlinked, as speech is often followed by an act that is often violent. We remember cases that are similar, a case of Lindohuhle Cele from Durban, who was brutally murdered in the presence of his community members. That on its own, for us, tells a story of a community that experienced a person being pelted with stones of hateful speech, which was later, or a couple of minutes, followed by a brutal stabbing of that individual as a result of the hate or a bias that was carried by their perpetrator. Like I said, conversion practices helped us a lot in terms of contextualizing hate in this space, and we have been asking ourselves questions for the longest time as to how do we address of hate. But one question that we haven't really sat down and contextualized as a country has always been around, why are people homophobic? Why are people transphobic? And to a greater extent, our study on conversion practices painted a picture for that. Now, these practices have been found to be harmful to victims who have reported secondary victimization and exclusion, some mental health challenges, as well as suicide attempts, if not successful in that regard. Corrective rape and the brutality directed to the community is also one form of conversion practice that is driven and motivated by hate. I will now hand over to Rorisang to touch on a bit on PEPUDA as the backdrop of hate crimes.
You are left with 1 minute.
Okay, thanks, I'll be quick. One thing which we see a lot happening within the LGBT community, we see that their rights actually are being diminished as justice is not really being served on these cases, which makes them very difficult to actually report their cases in that they scale of secondary victimization. We see that happening a lot in police stations when they're reporting cases. And on that, for example, we have a case which we had, whereby it's been going on for already 2 years, and justice not being served. There's a whole lot of irregular proceedings on that one. And we believe that with implementing the hate bill, will be actually being promoting their rights to be upheld, because we even see that regardless of Section 36, which is the limitation of rights, in that it's just to promote that everyone's rights is equal, regardless of them being LGBTI. We see that we're failing to actually uphold that particular section of the Constitution. And with that PEPFUDA, I would be that if PEPFUDA could be actually upheld, and irrespective with the Section 36, we will be able to treat everyone within the LGBTI with equality, and human dignity. With that being said, we would like to uphold that the hate speech bill should actually be published. I thank you.
Thank you very much, sir. Members, any questions? I see none. Thank you very much. Can we now invite Southern Africa Liaison Office?
Good afternoon, Chair, honorable members. I'll kindly request permission to share my screen from the administrator, please.
Mr. Somia, you have 20 minutes. Mr. Somia, you may proceed.
Apologies, Chair. I was muted. good afternoon, Chair, and colleagues of the committee and honorable members. My name is Lazi Somia. I'm from the Southern African Liaison Office. I'm with my colleague, Musiswe Nxumalo, and today we'll be presenting on behalf of the Southern African Liaison Office. Who is the Southern African Liaison Office? We are a civil society organization that has been actively involved in consensus building through engagements in SADC, particularly concerning international relations, foreign policy, women empowerment, people's security, and human rights. SADC's approach to building national, regional, and international consensus by creating safe spaces for formal and informal dialogues amongst between state and non-state actors, informing key policymakers, which includes this committee in this instance, and generating in-depth knowledge production and analysis. SALO is a catalyst for strategic engagement, alignment, and consensus building between African governments, civil society stakeholders with global partners on critical areas of democracy, peace and security, and human rights. SALO contributes to African-driven policy positions for countries with systemic challenges through advocacy, dialogue, research, and knowledge resources. It amplifies the voices of regional civil society for them to facilitate engagement with Southern African-based policymakers, in this instance, the South African Parliament. Next. The Southern African, from the get-go, we would like to share our primary premises that the Southern African Liaison Office supports the bill on the following grounds. It assists in upholding the rights that are enshrined in South Africa's Constitution, particularly the Bill of Rights Sections 9 and Sections 10, Sections 12, 1, and Sections 12, 2, hate crimes and hate speech. The bill reaffirms South Africa's commitment to international instruments and resolutions to the protection of vulnerable and marginalized groups. It grants further provisions for the aggravation of sentences for criminal cases of people from guilt of committing hate crimes and hate speech. It creates an additional layer of repercussions that one can hate crimes and hate speech, thus providing an additional punitive and rehabilitative step towards rehabilitating those who conduct hate crimes and hate speech. And finally, it acts as an additional deterrent for potential perpetrators of hate crimes and hate speech in South Africa. However, what we do realize that there are missing aspects of the law. South Africa throughout its democratic history has reaffirmed international statutes and international resolutions. However, the bill should not be limited to international statutes alone. It should also reaffirm the resolutions and commitments we have made to the international community, including the African Commission Human Rights and People's Rights Resolutions 275. And the Commission for the Convention for the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination. While the bill does acknowledge that South Africa commits to upholding the UN World Conference Declaration, it should reaffirm the Declaration on Racism, Racial Discrimination, Xenophobia, and Related Intolerances and Program and Action, including subsequent related United Nations General Assembly resolutions. This also feeds into South African peer review mechanism, which itself identified issues around attacks around migrants in South Africa and issues around violence against the LGBT community as issues of concern in our previous review report. This bill should also note the role of civil society acknowledging the equivalent declaration on practical solutions on ending violence, discrimination against persons on sexual orientation and gender identity and expression. On the issue of xenophobia, recent months, we have seen a spike in xenophobic attacks within South Africa. And part and parcel of this is social cleavages are facilitated by resentment of the other. And most instances, when situations are bad economically or socially, the most vulnerable within the community themselves are usually met at the receiving end. So on xenophobia, the bill in clause 3 and clause 4 describes the grounds for discrimination. Subsections K and subsections KK of clause 3 and 4 respectively describes the grounds as of national, migrant, and refugee status. Our suggestion is that nationality should be rephrased as nationality, migrant, refugee, or any other documentation status. The justification for this is that there has been a misguided rise in vigilante activism targeted at persons who are accused of being undocumented. Whilst the violence is criminalized under the current legislative framework, classifying this form of violence as a hate crime would aggravate circumstances of sentencing proceedings should an individual person be found guilty of committing such crimes. And therefore, this presents an additional deterrent mechanism in order for the criminal justice system to take appropriate steps in addressing specific acts of xenophobia, and for us as South Africa to account to the international community that we are doing something at addressing the international community's concern about our attitudes towards migrants and other persons who are not born within our borders. On hate crimes and hate speech against the LGBT community, FELA recommends the adoption of a SOGI definition of sexual orientation, gender identity, and expression and affirming approach. SOGI refers to the sexual orientation and gender identity and expression and describes a wider spectrum of all people, not only in the LGBT community. It is now being introduced in many legal documents from the United Nations documents and is also becoming popular on social media, something that Parliament needs to get on board in the latest use of language, in particular related to social circumstances. As language evolves, parliamentary and legislative processes need to evolve. It's useful and lies in its inclusiveness. The term LGBT is specific to individuals who identify as lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender. So SOGI refers to the characteristics common to all human beings, as everyone has a sexual orientation or a gender identity and everyone experiences a gender not just individuals who identify as lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender. And then that was a quote by Kipu Johnson on a handbook of SOGI. The bill fails to deal with the issue of expression, that excluding some of those marginalized in the discourse around hate crimes and hate speech. Hate crimes and hate speech committed, even on the grounds of perceived expression, must be taken into consideration. Because even on the grounds of perceived discretion, whether the person identifies or not, upon the legislatively identified grounds, notions of expression themselves often lead to violence or perceptions of one's expression. Therefore, we must be cognizant of the nuances on the ground when dealing when legislating and therefore providing protections for those often marginalized. For the next slide, I'll hand over to my colleague, Musiwe Dumalo.
Thank you very much. Moving on to the possible amendments to strengthen the bill. We need to add the definition of discrimination to read as discrimination as defined in the Promotion of Equality and Prevention of Unfair Discrimination Act 4 of 2000, which is under PAPUDA, or includes the full definition from PAPUDA. This bill should include discrimination, which is any act or omission, including a policy, law, rule, practice, condition, or situation, which is directly or indirectly, under subsection A, imposes a burden in obligations or disadvantage, under subsection B, withhold benefits or opportunities or advantages from any persons or one or more prohibited on the grounds of PAPUDA. The justification for this is to ensure that the legislation is clear in what it means by various concepts, as legislation has to be friendly to the public to allow citizens for a full appreciation of the legislative which is enshrined in their rights. Under the discrimination against any other vulnerable groups, South Africa has a history of stigmatization against persons with HIV and AIDS. However, the evolution of society and the emergence of new elements has generated new forms of stigmatization. There needs to be an amendment to clause 3 and 4 as it currently reads. It says HIV status. It should change to HIV status or any other disease, and the same applies to clause 4. By doing so, the legislation will encapsulate any possible future eventuality concerning stigmatization or any other discrimination of persons based on their condition. The prevention and combating of hate crimes and hate speech, also in addition to clause 9, should read that the Department of Social Development should recruit, train, and upskill qualified and social and care workers on educating communities on available public services to prevent and combat hate crimes and hate speech. Under subsection A, the department must ensure the sufficient resources that are allocated to end this. And under subsection B, the minister with the responsibility of social development should also report annually to Parliament on the progress made. The second is that the ministry entrusted with the responsibility of basic education should train and upskill educators and teachers on hate crime and hate speech prevention tools, and these should be integrated into the circular. The first is that the Department of Basic Education should make sufficient resources available to accomplish this. The second is that the minister shall assemble a team of experts to design a curriculum to meet this, and the minister shall be held accountable to Parliament on social attitudes on the basic education space on an annual basis. I'll now hand back over to my colleague, Lars.
Furthermore, we, in order to address issues of hate crimes and hate speech and combat it on a multiple level, local, provincial, and national government must work hand-in-hand with communities and community-based organizations in dealing with existing patterns of discrimination against persons on the grounds expressed in clauses 3 and 4. The Department of Planning, Monitoring, and Evaluation should ensure the monitoring and evaluation of intervention strategies from various spheres of government and report to Parliament on an annual basis on progress being made. And the Department of Arts and Culture and Sports to formulate policy guidelines for social policing councils and various spheres of government. Ultimately, what we seek to do with the Hate Crimes and Hate Speech Bill is create a society that is not only inclusive of those who have historically been marginalized. We need to create a society that is also cognizant that those who have already been marginalized by society are very important in their protection. And this is the beginning of a process of acknowledging the existence of those who are often being marginalized and invisibilized by the system. And therefore, the importance of passing the bill not only reaffirms Parliament's commitment to social justice and transformation, but it also fundamentally ensures that Parliament and the South African government are conscious of the social plight of our people. Thank you.
Thank you very much to both of you. Are there any questions? Seems to be clear. Members and everybody on the virtual platform, we have come to the end of our first leg of our public hearings on hate crime, hate speech bill. The second leg, which is going to be the last leg of our public hearings, is going to be communicated in due course, but most probably it would be in April when we come back from recess. But we will communicate with all the affected parties the date of the second leg of our public hearing. This meeting has come to an end. Thank you very much for everybody who has joined us on the virtual platform and members and the support staff. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. Good night.
Okay. Thank you.